It's my great pleasure to welcome Achin Jain today. He's visiting us from the University of Pennsylvania, where he's pursuing a PhD in the ECE department. Before joining UPenn, Achin got his undergraduate degree at the Indian Institute of Technology, Delhi, and then a master's degree at ETH Zurich. He has broad interests in machine learning, statistics, control theory, and optimization applied to cyber-physical systems. And today he is going to present some very interesting work that forms part of his PhD thesis?
Correct.
Okay, great. Welcome, Achin.
Thanks, Shaz, for the introduction and for organizing my trip here. I'm very excited to be at MSR to talk about my research on bridging machine learning and controls. So machine learning and control theory are two foundational but disjoint communities. So for example, machine learning requires data to build the models, and control theory requires models to provide performance, safety, or stability guarantees. So the fundamental challenge lies in developing new learning algorithms that are also suitable for control. So there could be many different applications you might think of, for example, in building control, process control, or control of autonomous systems. My current efforts are on applying this to building control for volatile energy markets. So my talk is divided into two parts. So in the first part, I'll answer a simple question. How can we use machine learning to synthesize control-oriented models? And in the second part, I'll show how you can use these models for smart or advanced energy analytics. So let me begin by giving you a brief motivation about the problem we are trying to solve. So back in early 2015, so this was one of the articles that was published in Scientific American, we said 2014 is officially the hottest year on record. After almost 1 year, we said 2015 is officially the hottest year. And guess what? Now 2016 is even hotter than 2015. So every year we are setting a record for the hottest year ever, and by a bigger margin. And contrary to some alternate facts, climate change is actually happening, and it's happening very fast. So what this means for us, I mean all of us, is we are witnessing price volatility. So this is just one example of how dynamic the prices of electricity are. This is from the eastern coast of the US. On 20th July 2015, during hot summer afternoon, around 4 p.m., the price of the electricity, it increased from $25 to $800 per megawatt hour. And this is a 32-fold increase, not 32%. If you already think this is too much, then have a look at this. This is during the polar vortex season on 24 January 2014. The price of electricity increased 86 times, and it's increased from $30 to over $2,680. So price volatility has become new normal. When 4 days after we witnessed an 86-fold increase, this is the price on 20th of January 2014, when right from 5 a.m. in the morning to 9 p.m. in the evening, the price is changing continuously. And the average price around this time is over like $250 to $300 per megawatt hour. So all kilowatts are not created equally. And one clean and efficient way to mitigate the effects of price volatility is through demand response. So what is demand response? Demand response basically means how consumers or the end users, they change their consumption pattern in response to price volatility. So what typically happens is the utility companies, whenever they anticipate a peak in the demand in the forecast, so they'll issue a notification to the end users. And this includes residential buildings, commercial buildings, academic institutions. And they'll say, if you curtail X kilowatts, we'll pay you Y dollars. So what happened in a particular instance is the campus of University of Pennsylvania received a call from Enernoc, which is a grid operator in the Philadelphia region. And they said, if you curtail 2 megawatts, we'll pay you $440,000. So the facilities people, they weren't really sure. And they're like, OK, maybe you can curtail 1 megawatt. And then they heard back saying, we'll pay you $90,000. So this is not even prorated. If only the facilities were sure of how much they can curtail or how much flexibility do they have, they would have easily saved over $300,000. So the point is, under such an event, the facilities or the building operators, they have to decide what are the right control actions they must take to reduce or mitigate the effects of price volatility. I mean, how can they reduce the power consumption by taking the right actions? And when they do that, curtailing their unessential loads, it leads to a sustained DR curtailment, leads to stability on the grid, and in return, the aggregators, they pay back the promised incentives. So this is a hard contract. If you violate the contract, then you also need to pay some severe penalties. So unfortunately, most of the demand response today is manual and it's done in a very ad hoc manner. So what people do is they'll already have some rule-based strategies and they'll select one out of these based on their intuition, which they think might give them the required curtailment. So it might curtail less than what they desire, so in which case they have to pay a very severe penalties, or it might curtail more, in which case you'll have some uncomfortable thermal conditions inside the building and people might complain. So to give you a sense of complexity, how intractable it is at large scales, so this is the campus of University of Pennsylvania. We have over 187 buildings on campus, and the peak power consumption is around 72 megawatts. So when the building operators receive a request for curtailment, they have to decide among 292,000 parameters or settings, what is the right way, what setting would give them the desired curtailment. So clearly, this is not very intuitive to address. And
what is a SCADA tag?
So SCADA is basically the building energy management software. So it basically here refers to what all control settings they can choose, how many control options they have, and they have to decide among all these what is the best setting that will guarantee them the desired curtailment as well as some required thermal comfort. So what happened back in 2011 is the university exceeded its peak capacity for 30 minutes, and they had to pay a penalty of $720,000, which means $24,000 per minute. And to give you some perspective, this is actually very comparable to the salaries PhD students receive. So the name of the game is, how low can we go? Can we estimate what is the available energy flexibility? So there are two main challenges here. The first challenge is to be able to predict how much will the building consume under different conditions. For example, what would be the power consumption when there is no DR event? And this is something you need to predict in order to evaluate how much you can save. You need to make an estimate of the baseline from where you want to curtail. Then building operators also want to predict the power consumption when they take a DR action. That means if you have a predictive model like this, then they can evaluate different strategies and choose the right one wisely. So this is a very typical machine learning setup where, given some information about how the building operates, we want to predict what would be the power consumption. And if you have a predictive model like this, then the building operators, they can simulate different strategies without having to actually implement on the real building. They can know which might give them the required curtailment. A much harder problem is to actually be able to generate new strategies. So now instead of evaluating different strategies, we want to generate new strategies which are better than the existing rule-based methods. So in this case, our goal is to actually decide how much should we change the chill water temperature, by how much should we change the light level, by how much should we change the lighting or the zone temperatures in various zones. Because the building operators, they want to know what is the best change we can make. So data predictive control does exactly this. It generates set point recommendations that allows you to trade off between the load reduction as well as thermal comfort. So at this point, you might be wondering, why do we need to resort to machine learning methods? Why do we need to work with data? Why can't we just use physics-based model? So let me give you some insight into how the buildings are modeled today. And to give you a sense of complexity, how difficult it is to model using first principles. So broadly classified, we have three different approaches. We have a white box modeling, where we try to model every small detail of the building, how different inputs influence the output. And this is done in a purely physics-based manner based on first principles. And this is just too complex to model. Then a simpler one is a gray box modeling, where we still use physics-based principles, but this is a model reduced form of the white box modeling. So this is what people use. This is a state-of-the-art technique people use to control buildings. Then we have the black box modeling, where we throw away all the physics. So how do we do white box modeling? We take a real building, then we get access to the floor plans, HVAC layout, to see how different equipments, how the different ducts and how they are connected. And then we'll hire a building expert who will then go floor by floor, zone by zone, wall by wall, try to model every material that is used to construct the building. And he'll model thermal interactions, heat and mass flows. And all of this has to be done in a high-fidelity building simulation software like Energy Plus or Transys. This already sounds too tedious and cumbersome to do. And in many cases, we don't even have all this information available. We don't have access to the full layout or the detailed plans as we need for the first principle modeling. And so a lot of guesswork has to be done in guessing the parameter values in the model. And so we are not done yet. Once you have a simulation setup like this, then you want to match the response of the simulation to the actual building data. And to get the data in the first place, we need to install lots of new sensors. So this further adds to the cost of obtaining the white box model. And to give you an example, this is one of the buildings in Philadelphia. And this project was done in my lab as a part of a DOE-funded, Department of Energy-funded project. So it took over 9 months to model this building. So the goal was to generate a high-fidelity building model which can map the relationship between different control inputs to the output. And it took over 9 months and multiple PhDs to obtain this model. So what further adds to the complexity of modeling using the first principles is that each building is unique. So even if we have a model for one building, we cannot use it for any other building. The whole process has to be repeated, and there's no way we can use the sum tuned parameters from one building and apply it on another. And moreover, the material properties or the equipment, the properties are also changing with time. So we need to run this system identification again and again to basically update our model. So clearly, due to all these complexities, this white box modeling is very cost and time prohibitive, and it's not even suitable for model-based control. What people use for control is the gray box modeling, which has less number of parameters, but it's still based on first principles. So the alternate is the black box modeling. Now we don't care about the physics anymore. We just use some learning algorithms to map inputs to outputs. And now we don't need to worry about applying this to different models because we have the same process. We can just automate this for every building. And all we need to do is some feature engineering, select what are the right set of inputs that can explain our output. So people have been using this mostly for predictions. And it's been actually many decades. People have been applying machine learning algorithms to predict the power consumptions or.
So in this case, the input would be the temperature settings, for example.
Yes.
And or the light settings, and the output would be the power consumption.
Correct. Okay. And we could have more input. For example, we also want to model disturbances. How does weather influence your power consumption? Depending on what's the outside temperature, what's the humidity? Because depending on that, we also change our, we might consume more power. If it's too hot outside, our temperature set point is still the same. Because we always want maybe around 23 degrees Celsius, 24 degrees Celsius.
How do you collect the data for doing this kind of training of the model?
So the data we are using is basically from the thermostats, which can give you information about the temperatures. And then we use data from multimeters, which tell you about the power consumption patterns. And the weather data is available through forecast.
Right.
So basically, the data that we want to use to formalize such an approach is directly available. We don't need to add new sensors, or we don't need to change the existing setup. Even if we have to add something, it would be basically maybe something like a thermostat, which is not very expensive.
I see. What you're saying is that because of the thermostat, there is some kind of a control mechanism that is already adjusting it.
Yeah, correct.
So basically, based on the external.
If it is, for example, it's too hot outside, then you have to provide more chilling to set the same temperature.
But for example, the thermostat will always be a fixed value. So that particular input doesn't make any sense, right? Because the thermostat is fixed unless a human being goes and changes it.
Yes. So the point is, in many different zones, people might want different settings. So it's not uniform across all the rooms. So this is also one of the control variables, like you can change, or you may not want to change.
That particular variable, changing it is tedious because that requires human intervention. Changing the thermostat setting, right?
Yes.
unless you're doing some kind of a controlled experiment where you just sort of programmatically start changing it and observing.
So what typically can also be done is you can have all these control settings in your energy SCADA system or the dashboards. You can specify it there. I mean, you can also, typically we also have it here where you can manually change, but we can also change it from a central system.
SCADA. Yeah. Oh, I see. So you can automate it there.
Yeah.
I see, very interesting, okay.
Yeah. So the problem with the black box modeling is they are not suitable for control. We can do prediction very well, but how do we actually use this for control? So to summarize the different modeling approaches on scale of how...
Why is it not suitable for control? Oh, you'll explain?
Yeah, yeah, I'll just explain. So we have like the white box modeling, which is very difficult to model. And it's also unsuitable for control because of the modeling complexities, the number of parameters we have, the number of internal states we have. It makes it difficult for control. So then we have gray box modeling, which is also difficult to obtain because you need to run a lot of new experiments. You need to do functional testing, like system identification. You need to hire building experts who can guess some parameter values for you. So this is, this is still easier than the white box modeling. And this is also the state-of-the-art technique people use for building control. Then we have black box modeling, and which is currently not suitable for control. And the goal of my research is to make this suitable for control.
But you didn't explain why it is not suitable.
I'll come to that.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. So what you're basically doing is we are working with the physical systems. And in this case, it's a building. And we're taking data from sensors like thermostats and other monitoring devices like multimeters, weather data, and we are building a control-oriented model using machine learning. We are using tools like regression trees, random forests, Gaussian processes, and we have to modify this algorithm so that we can suit it for control. And once we have this control-oriented modeling, then we can apply predictive or the receding horizon control. So the existing solutions mostly are very reactive. They are based on rules, and they don't consider what's the current state. And with this, what DPC can do for you is both prediction and control accounting for your current state. So starting with the prediction, so we can already get very good results in prediction. So this is one of the buildings in, again, the same building, which initially took over 9 months to model. Now we can model in a few minutes and with a very high accuracy, as high as 97%. Then we can repeat, we did this for many buildings on Penn campus. And so we have a clinical research building. This the bottom right is actually the Wharton building. And for each of these, we can get very high accuracy. Now, the next question is, how do we actually do control? So I'll give you two different case studies. And with the help of these case studies, I'll demonstrate 2 points. First, how accurately we can synthesize control strategies using DPC. And second, how easily this method scales when model-based approaches cannot be used. So I'll start with the first one. So to make a comparison with a model-based approach like MPC, I actually need a physical model because MPC cannot run without a physics-based model. So I took this model of a building, and this is of an actual real building in Switzerland, in Basel. And the model was identified after running many experiments for many months. This was a part of an optical control project, which took multiple years, actually, to implement it on a real building. So I took the same model, and let me give a brief description of what the model gives us. So we have some building variables. The states of the building include zone temperature, slab temperature, and inside and outside wall temperatures. So of all these states, only one we can measure directly, that is the zone temperature. All the other states were modeled like by running some complex experiments. And this is not something we can do with our data-driven approaches. So for model-based control, I'll consider all the different all states. So because we know the model exactly, but for the data-driven approach, I'll consider just one state which we can measure directly from the sensors. So then we have the control variables on the right, which include the blind position, lighting, heating, and cooling. So we can adjust these control variables to change the zone temperature. And then we have external disturbances which come from weather, for example, solar gains, outside temperature, daylight illuminance. And then we have some internal gains given by heat gains due to occupancy and equipment. So disturbances are something which are out of our control. We cannot modify them. What we can change is the control inputs here, which are lighting, cooling, heating, and blind position to influence the zone temperature. All right. So now, if you want to do MPC, which is model predictive control on this model, our goal is to optimize four variables: blind position, lighting, heating, and cooling. And our objective is to keep the zone temperature close to a reference value. So we are trying to do a climate control in the building. So in the objective function, I have mainly two terms. The first one is for the temperature tracking, where I'm saying we want to keep the state, which is the zone temperature, close to a reference temperature. And then the second term is penalty on the actuator usage, which indirectly accounts for how much energy we use. The problem with this approach is, in reality, we don't know this physical model. This was obtained after running many complex experiments for many, many months. So what we want to do is, we want to replace this model dynamics by a set of predictive models. And this will come directly from using like machine learning algorithms. So why can't we use black box model for control? So let's say we have any black box model here denoted by F, where we are predicting output Y, and we have M features, X1 to XM. This could be any model. Let's say this is a random forest. And we have N such models because we want to do predictive control. We want to predict also in the future. So you can think of this as N steps into the future. So we'll have one different model for each time step. So the prediction problem is very straightforward. Given some features, we want to predict what the output is. Given X is, we want to predict what Y is. The control problem is actually inverse of this. Here, what we want is, for a given Y, we want what's the optimal X. So we want to optimize the features, find the right set of features that provide us the a given value of Y. So the optimization problem we are solving is, in most of the control problem, is what I have here at the bottom, where we have we want to track the output, and we want to optimize the X's or the control variables in a model. And now imagine if this F is a random, this function is a random forest, then this is non-convex, this is non-differentiable, and doesn't have any closed form expression. So solving this optimization is a huge mess, and you have to resort to some randomized procedure or some evolutionary algorithm, especially when you have large number of features, when your prediction horizon is long. This optimization becomes very hard to solve. So, and to solve a control problem, we want to have some nice properties about the model, some nice properties.
It seems to me that, forget about optimization, just finding out X1 to XM, which will make the function evaluate to a particular Y, might itself be a very hard problem.
That's
that's just a function inversion problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Optimization problem, right?
Exactly.
Because this thing could be, you may just end up resorting to some like guess and check or something like that.
Correct.
Okay.
So yeah, what people have tried is try to do some sensitivity analysis, like you are operating at some X's, and then what will happen when you slightly change X, fix all the others, change X1, and see how much change you get.
These are search heuristics, basically.
Yes, these are some heuristics what people use.
Okay.
So we want to simplify this optimization problem so that we can do control with black box model. So our goal is basically to simplify this optimization problem. So we started working with regression tree-based models. And the main reason is because they're very interpretable.
So what is a regression tree model?
I'll explain how it works. So it's basically a set of rules. You can basically represent the prediction of building power consumption by a set of rules like this, where you say, you check the outside temperature, you check which day of week it is, what hour of day it is, and while tracking the conditions, you'll have one prediction for each possible condition. So such type of rule-based models are very interpretable, and this is what building operators like. I mean, because it's very easy to understand or trace what's really going on. And because they want to make sure whatever prediction and recommendation we are getting is trustworthy. So before I tell you how we actually do control with regression trees, let me just spend a couple of minutes on how the trees are trained in the first place. So the tree regression tree approach is basically the recursive partitioning of our data space. So our goal is basically to determine how we decide our splits or the partitions in order to minimize the least square error. So If you want to solve this optimization, if you're looking for a global optimum, this is a very difficult problem because this is actually a combinatorial optimization. You want to find all possible splits that might minimize the error between your prediction as well as prediction and the training data. What people do instead is they look for suboptimal solutions and they look for greedy approach to solve this optimization. So one way of doing this is solving an optimization problem like the one I have here, where our goal is to determine two variables. One, because we are partitioning, the partitioning comes from what feature we want to use for partition and what's the value of that feature that is used for the partition. For example, if I have a partition as x1 equal to t1, that would split my data space into two parts. So here, for the sake of simplicity, I'm assuming we only have two features. So our data is spread across this map, and each of the sample has output y. You can think of that as think of it as a third dimension. So if I have a split at x1 equal to t1, I get two partitions. For each of the partition, I can calculate the error given by the optimization problem above. I can say what's the error for all the samples here. I can sum all the errors. Then I'll choose the partition which minimizes this error. And so basically, you will consider all possible values of your features, all possible values each feature can take, and choose the right combination which minimizes this error. And you can repeat this again and again for every small partition until you get a very small space where you can where you satisfy some stopping criterion. For example, the minimum number of samples in a partition.
So are you going to learn even the stopping criterion? Is that part of the optimization space?
So stopping criterion is usually a hyperparameter. Like you choose a hyperparameter such that your prediction, your error is minimum. For example, what depth of the tree you want. So you can repeat this again and again, and then you get a tree structure like this. So basically, your output in a particular partition is average of all the output in this, of the samples present in that partition. For example, if I have a condition x1 less than t1 and x2 less than t2, which is the first branch of the tree, then we go to the left bottom partition and we average all the samples, average the output of all the samples to get the prediction. So this would be the prediction of our regression tree. So now I'll show you what's the problem of using the tree approach directly.
Can you go back? I'm still trying to wrap my head around the optimization space. So one tree, like the one that you're showing in the bottom right part of your slide,
mm-hmm.
will give you one function. And you are trying to find the best function amongst all such functions.
Correct.
But the set of all such functions is infinite, right?
Yes, so that's why this optimization is very hard. So instead of solving the global optimization, like looking for a global optimum, we are looking for a suboptimal solution. And this is done by solving this optimization problem at every splitting point. So as I said, so we start with the full space. To determine the first split, we'll calculate for all possible combinations of feature and its corresponding value what would be the error given by this expression. So we have here, if you see, I've conditioned this over the splitting variable. I have two partitions here. Left is xj less than t, and right is xj greater than t. So I'll calculate this error for all possible combinations of splitting or the feature and the value it can take. I'll choose the best one, and then I'll repeat this for the next partition, and again and again. And then I say the output is, once we get the partition, and the output is average of all the samples in that partition.
This is going to terminate. I'm still not sure what the termination condition of this optimization problem is.
So termination condition is, we can specify, for example, how many minimum number of samples you want in a partition. Once you have, let's say, your minimum leaf criteria is 10, so it will stop if a next partition will give it less than 10 samples in a partition.
But even like you're choosing this T1, T2, T3, right? If it's a dense space, it can be so many T1, T2, T3s that you can choose, right?
So yeah, typically what people do is you discretize.
Okay, first you're going to discretize.
Yeah. If it's a continuous space.
Okay, I guess what you're telling me is that there's a whole bunch of setup that happens.
Yeah.
To circumscribe the problem so that it becomes tractable.
Yeah.
You're not describing all that
Correct.
Setup.
Exactly.
In this slide. Okay, all right. Let's keep going.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is just what exists already. I've not done anything new here.
Okay, all right.
Now, there's a problem of using this approach. I'll show you what. So now, I'll go to the same model where we have some weather data. We have some building data. And so I said, zone temperature is something we are predicting. So it's the output of our model. And all the other variables in red are the disturbances, something which we cannot change. Then we have the control variables in green. These are the variables we want to optimize in order to adjust our zone temperature to a reference value. So our goal is to have a predictive model where we want to predict the zone temperature for multiple time steps. At time step k, we want to predict from k plus 1 to k plus n. And the features of our model include the disturbances, which is something which we cannot control, some autoregressive terms of the output to improve the accuracy of the model, and then the control variables, something we want to change in runtime optimization. So we can classify all the features basically into two categories, control variables and the variables which we cannot control or the non-manipulated variables. So the control problem is, for a given y, we want to optimize the axis in red or in green. All the other variables we know exactly. Now, if we apply the same regression tree approach in the control problem, we might get splitting on both the disturbances as well as the control variables. So in runtime optimization, because we don't know what the control feature is, we cannot follow the path. Now, here our goal is, for a particular y, we want to determine what the right control variable is. And now, if the splitting is based on both, we cannot follow. It's very difficult. This optimization is, again, combinatorial. So to resolve this problem, we break this training process into two steps. Now, instead of training a tree on all the features, we train the trees only on the disturbances, which we know for sure, or we know from forecast. And once we have the tree structure, we have the partitioning of the space. Then in each partition, instead of using the average, which is what people use in the standard tree approach, we fit a linear model, which is a function of the control variables. So now, given the disturbances, I can trace down the path. I can reach a partition in my data space. And then here, I can fit a linear model, which explains the output. In this case, this is a temperature, and shows its relationship with the control variables. And this is a simple linear model. Most of the non-linearities in the model are captured by the tree structure. And once, for a given set of disturbances, basically, you can pick a linear regression model that explains the output in response to the control variables. So while training, we have information about both control variables as well as disturbances. In runtime optimization, we only know disturbances. We don't know control.
So the linear model is a support vector machine?
No, this is simple linear regression. So once I decide the partition, I figure out what all training data is present in each partition. Then I pick the features, the control features of each of the sample. I take the output. I train a linear model on those samples. There is no particular reason. This is just one model structure that seems to work for this problem. It's basically the same as saying, like, why would we have some other model structure? Why not this? And for this particular problem, if we see the model accuracy of splitting this process into two steps, it's still very good. It's accurate enough for control.
By the way, I remember you reported these accuracy numbers. Can you give me a little background on how those accuracy numbers were calculated?
Those were for only prediction. So we calculate the prediction. We know from the test sample, like we split the training and testing. And then for the test samples, we know the actual one. And we have the predictive one. Then we just calculate the normalized root mean square error to see how much accuracy we have. So now we can train one such tree for every prediction step, because I want to predict for multiple time steps, not just one. We want to do predictive control so that we can act in advance.
I have one more question. Sure. I'm not calibrated on these numbers. Like when you said 96% accuracy, is that respectable?
I'll show you in my in prediction, it seems like very good, like 97-98%. But when it comes to control, I'll show you what difference it can make.
Okay.
Like for different approaches, how it can really change your control output.
Yeah.
Because that is finally what we are interested in knowing, how good we can control. Because prediction doesn't actually tell you much about how algorithms are doing.
But I mean, isn't it true that typically the better your prediction, the better your control is going to be,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, if you have a 100% accurate model, then you cannot do better than that.
That's right.
Yeah.
So do you optimize over the linear model? Is that... So to find the controllable variables, you end up getting as input the linear model. Because all the...
Yes, correct. I'll exactly show you how we solve the optimization in my next slide.
Okay.
So... Now what we are basically doing is, we have one such model for each prediction time step where the tree is trained only on the disturbances. And then in the leaves, we have trained a linear regression model based on the samples that were present in each leaf. And now this is how we do runtime control. So in runtime, we have information about the disturbances using forecast or some estimation. And then, so given the disturbances, we can, in each prediction step, we can trace down the path, and then we can select the linear regression model for that particular disturbance. For if we change the disturbance, we might end up in some different leaf, and this might give us a different linear model. So once we obtain the linear models, then we can solve the optimization problem, where our objective is very similar to what I showed you before. Here, again, we want to do temperature tracking, and the difference is, if you compare with the model-based approach, the model predictive control, we have replaced the model dynamics by a set of linear regression model. And these linear regression model change from time step to time step. So now we can do control with regression trees. Now we can also extend this to a random forest. So it's a very simple extension and it seems to work pretty well. Now instead of one tree for each time step, I have a forest for each time step. So a random forest is basically a collection of many such trees trained on different subset of data, different set of features. Because of this randomness, we tend to get very high accuracy because we reduce the variance because of independence of different trees. Now, here what we are doing is, now for each time...
I don't understand, how does the forest represent the function? I understand how a single tree represents the function, but it gives you a deterministic way of calculating it. How does a forest represent the function?
So let's say we have 100 trees in a forest, each of which is trained on different set of features and different set of samples.
Okay.
So for any test sample, I can navigate through each tree to calculate the output,
okay.
And then I simply average the output of all 100 trees.
Okay.
This is how random forest works.
Okay.
Now, very analogously, what we do is, for each time step, in a forest, I have hundreds of trees. Given a disturbance, I can pick linear models from each tree. And I simply average out the coefficients. And the result is the linear regression model, the final linear regression model that I get, the average one, is in prediction much better than a single tree. And now we can solve the optimization problem again and to calculate what is the right set of inputs that would keep my zone temperature close to a reference value. And so these are some results from the simulation, what we obtained. So I'm comparing three different approaches. Model predictive control, which is the optimal, or is the benchmark we want to compare to. Then we have single tree approach in yellow. And in red is a DPC with ensemble method or DPC with random forest. On top right, you can see the plot of temperature, which shows you how the zone temperatures vary for three different methods. And the dashed lines show you the constraints in the optimization. We can see the red and blue curves are actually close. And in yellow, we see a lot of variation. And this variation is mostly because of model overfitting in regression trees. On the left, I have two plots, one for the control input, which is cooling, and the other is heating. And again, we can see that with random forest in blue, a random forest in red, and MPC in blue, the control strategies are very similar, the cooling and heating, they start at the same time, they end at the same time, and they're using very similar power. With the trees, we observe a lot of variation, and this is not good for practical purposes. And again, this is attributed to the model inaccuracy in a tree. But with forest, we can actually generate control strategies which are very similar to a model-based controller like MPC. So now we can generate control strategies which are actually very similar to MPC and which assumes the model is accurate. And we did not even model everything. For example, I just modeled the zone temperatures. I did not model all the remaining temperatures, internal states of the model, because we just want to work with the real data that's coming out from the building. In the next case study, I'll show you how this approach scales easily on a very large building. So I have a full-blown Energy Plus model. So Energy Plus is basically a high-fidelity building simulation software where you can model to a very great detail how the building is how the building operates. This particular building is 12-story. It has 19 different zones, and the peak power under peak conditions is consuming 1.6 megawatts, and there are 2,400 people. So such a model is not suitable for model-based control, because obtaining the physics-based model for this building, it will take many, many months, perhaps years, and hundreds and thousands of dollars, which is not suitable. So now I'll show how we can implement DPC, the same approach with forest on this model. So we are working with this data, where our output is the building power consumption. And then we have weather variable, which include temperature, humidity, wind conditions, solar radiations. We have proxy variables like time of day, day of week, and day of month, which account for the occupancy, because occupancy is also a very important factor that influences the heat conditions inside the buildings. Because we cannot measure occupancy directly, we add some proxy variables to account for that. Then we have, for 19 different zones, we have zone temperature information available through thermostats. And then there are some schedule variables which building operators change to influence the thermal conditions or the power consumption. Of all these, I'll consider only 3 control inputs. So all the remaining are basically fixed. We don't need to optimize. So I'm considering the following scenario. Now, whenever the aggregators, they anticipate a peak in the demand, I said they issue a notification to all the end consumers. And for this particular building, the contract says we have to curtail to, or we have to operate at 1.1 megawatt between 3 to 4 p.m. Now, the job of the building operators is to decide 3 set points: the cooling set point, the chilled water set point, and the lighting level. They want to choose this set point such that they can keep the building power consumption close to 1.1 megawatt. So because we want to predict power consumption, we need a predictive model for power consumption. So on the left, I have models or random forest for power consumption, which predict power consumption in the same way. In the trees are based, again, on only on the disturbances. And then we have a linear regression model in the leaves. More than that, we have a predictive model for temperature of a particular zone. So we have 19 different zones. And when we are reducing the power consumption, we want to add some thermal or the comfort constraints in a particular zone. For example, this could be the CEO's office. When we are reducing the energy usage, we don't want to influence that particular zone. So to show you how flexible we are in optimization, I'm adding this constraint. So now our goal is, again, to determine 3 control actions. What should be the chill water temperature, cooling set point, and lighting set point? We solve the optimization problem on the right, where in the objective function,
this optimization problem is going to be solved dynamically.
In runtime.
How expensive is this?
This is a simple convex program. That's the main advantage. Like initially I said, the black box model, if you put directly in the optimization, it makes the optimization very complex because of non-convexities, non-linearities. And in this case, because we have a linear regression model, now the optimization is simple, is convex. And it's much easier to solve. It's very similar to what an actual MPC algorithm would take, which is the benchmark.
This thing, is this basically like simplex? Is that what you're talking about here, the simplex algorithm?
Simplex works only with the linear case.
I see.
Here, the objective is the quadratic objective. So basically, if we have a convex problem, then we can guarantee a global optimum for this, for that problem. If we have non-convexities, then we cannot guarantee that thing. And there's no way actually to guarantee optimality.
What is the complexity of this of the solution here?
So this takes less than a few seconds to solve.
I know. I meant like a worst case complexity analysis.
So
in
that
terms of the problem size.
So for this problem size, like here, I have like three control variables. I had a half an hour long horizon, 5 minute time step, and even this I could solve on my desktop computer. I did not try some fancy computational techniques, but even on my desktop computer, it was taking less than like 30 seconds to solve.
Okay.
I mean, we have enough tools to make that computation faster.
So you're using some off-the-shelf convex optimization library or something?
Yes, I'm using Cplex by IBM.
Okay.
It's a commercial optimization solver. It's available for students for free. So we are basically solving the optimization problem on the right, where in the objective, we want to keep the power consumption at some reference value. In this case, this is 1.1 megawatt. And if you notice, I have a summation over from 1 to n. That means I have to ensure this for next few time steps, not just current time step. So the linear regression model constraints come from the random forest. For a given set of disturbances, we can figure out what linear constraints we have to use. And then I have linear regression model constraints also for the zone temperature. So as I said earlier, we select one zone, and this could be the CEO's office, where we don't want to have any effect of the curtailment. So we can specify the temperatures inside this particular zone has to be it has to be very comfortable there. And clearly, this optimization problem is very flexible. You can think of adding more or different objective functions. For example, earlier we were doing temperature tracking. Here I'm doing power tracking. So this is very flexible. And now for this particular model, our goal was to keep the power consumption close to 1.1 megawatt. And in the blue line is what the model actually returns after we generated optimal strategy. So we can clearly operate close to 1.1 megawatt. And this is shown in blue. And in red is what the model thinks the power consumption is. Because of some model inaccuracies, we cannot clearly have 100% accuracy. So there has to be some difference. And this is the maximum error we get is close to 5%. And these are the optimal control strategies that were generated. The chill water temperature in dark blue, and the dash blue is cooling is in solid blue, and the lighting is in a dash red. So what you can notice is, so these control settings are at 3 o'clock, they changed rapidly because initially the building was operating at 1.4 megawatt. To reduce to 1.1 megawatt, you see a sudden change in the control settings, and then you make gradual adjustments to keep the power consumption close to 1.1 megawatt. All right, so our next goal is to actually apply this to real buildings. And so we have full access to a building in University of L'Aquila in Italy, where we are also allowed to do our own experiments. So right now we are in the phase of like collecting data. We had to modify some building SCADA systems to get out like this data that we want. So once we are done with that, we are actually going to try and implement this on a real building. And then we are also in talks with the Philadelphia Navy Yard, where they have said they can give us an access to unregulated electrical microgrid. Okay, so right now what we have seen is how we can do control-oriented modeling using black box model, especially in this case a random forest, and how we can use that for prediction as well as control. Our next goal is to use this for interactive analytics. So the current energy dashboard systems, they are very fixed, they are rigid, in the sense that they just tell you what's embedded inside them. If you want something more, for example, what will happen in the future, you have to change the dashboard or the software, and they're very restrictive. What building operators, they want to know is what will happen in the future. How can they act in order to avoid effects of price volatility? And currently, these dashboards are mostly used for some monitoring or visualization, some simple analytics, or maybe for anomaly detection when something flashes on the screen. What we are doing is, now with predictive and control-oriented model, we can do much more than this. We are building a voice-enabled energy analytics engine, which allows you to ask a wide variety of questions. For example, now you can ask questions like, how much will the building consume 3 hours from now? What are the consumption patterns for different buildings on the campus? You can verbally ask, what would be the control set point recommendations for building 99 from 5 to 6 p.m. tomorrow? And in the background, it will run the required predictive or DPC algorithms and procedurally generate the dashboards and show the results on the screen as the facilities want. So to demonstrate this, I'll show you a quick video where we are using Amazon Echo for natural language interaction. And I'll show you how we can ask all these type of questions.
Alexa, start Energy Advisor.
Welcome to the Alexa Energy Advisor skill.
Describe the conditions for Huntsman Hall.
For Huntsman Hall, what is the wattage you are expecting?
100 kilowatts.
The building Huntsman Hall used 100 kilowatts on average around 3 p.m. when the temperature is 18.7 degrees Celsius and humidity is 72.2%.
So this was a simple like monitoring question. It's just reading or simple database lookup, doing some statistical analysis of what were the different possible conditions for a given power consumption. And it generates all these results and shows on the screen. And then we can do more than this. We can ask more predictive and control-oriented questions.
Show the predicted consumption for July 17th.
On July 17th, 2017, the peak expected power is about 1.5 megawatts.
What if I change lighting level to 30 and chilled water temperature to 8?
Between which start and end times would you like these changes evaluated?
This is asking the user
from 9:03 p.m. to 5 p.m.
Now you can evaluate different strategies and see which one will give you less power.
0.8% less energy would be used.
What should be my set points for the best strategy for Huntsman Hall?
This is a controlled recommendation question where it will invoke the DPC algorithm to generate the answers.
The optimal settings are lighting at 80%, chilled water at 10 degrees Celsius, and zone temperature at 28 degrees Celsius from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m.
So basically what we are doing here is, for every query, we can classify its intent, what kind of query it is. Is it a predictive question? Is it a control recommendation question? Is it simple database lookup? And for each kind of query, we have our callback functions.
Being done by Alexa software or something that you implemented?
This can be done using Echo, Alexa. You can modify the Alexa skill set for your own problem. And just a small bit of coding required, but it's very flexible. And so depending on the query, we extract the relevant arguments from the query, and we call the callback function. For example, if this is a control recommendation query, we know we have to invoke the DPC algorithm. It will solve the optimization, generate the control strategy, which would be a numerical response, and then we can use this to display on the screen or also return it back in form of a verbal response. So I'll just summarize my talk now. So what I showed you is with DPC, or data predictive control, we can clearly avoid the modeling cost in cases where modeling is very difficult. Modeling of like real building, and if you want to model the entire campus, modeling based on first principles is very difficult. And using data predictive control, we can avoid that modeling cost. Then we can do predictive or the receding horizon control, which is typically not very easy with a black box model. And then with help of two examples, I showed you how accurately we can synthesize control strategies and how easily it scales to.
What's an example of a black box model, like a DNN or something?
In general, any learning algorithm like a neural network or random forest or even a support vector machine is a black box.
But you were able to use random forest.
Yeah, this is why, like, our approach, yeah, now we can do it, but earlier we could not.
But what I'm trying to understand is that the approach that you pulled off here, is there something specific to the structure of these regression trees, or you know, collection of regression trees, or would it work even if I had something like DNN inside there?
So yeah, this approach is very specific to regression trees and random forests, and so you can think of this as one solution to doing control with black box model. Another solution could be if someone can come up with doing control with neural networks, with deep learning. This would be another solution to the same problem,
okay,
which right now does not exist. I mean, reinforcement learning is another flavor, like where you can do control. It's a formulation of an optimal control. It's another type of solution, but it's not suited for this application because in that case, you have to actually learn by trial and error. And to do this experiment in closed loop for a real building, run it for a very long time, it's not very practical. So one thing I did not talk about is the stability aspect. So in many applications, for many control problems, stability is very important. For buildings, it's not that relevant because the buildings are inherently very stable. It's very low risk of getting a building unstable because the system is so slow. And if you think of faster systems like a quad rotors, they are inherently unstable. So if we want to apply approaches like this there, then we have to also guarantee stability. So we just started working on this problem so that we can apply and take this approach to different, like more complex or faster dynamical application.
Well, there's another thing that there you have issues of real-time control. So the time horizon for making control decisions is very small.
Yeah,
you can't even take 30
exactly.
seconds, for example. That's too much.
Yeah. For buildings, we can also take 5 minutes because assembling time is just too high. And for faster systems, you have to act like your assembling time is very, very small. So you have to operate at very high frequencies. And then another thing that I did not cover in this talk is the robustness of this approach. For example, because we are working directly with the sensor data, what might happen if one or the other sensor fails? Then can we still trust these recommendations? Can we still trust the predictions? Or what would actually happen in the model, in the algorithm? Or what would happen when there is uncertainty in the forecast of the disturbances? Because we are using disturbances, and we're assuming we have some estimated value. If you have some uncertainty in there, then how do we use the same approach there? So this is another line of, this is a part of a future work we want to address. And then lastly, I showed you how we can use these algorithms for interactive analytics. Yeah, with this, I'd like to close, and I'll take any further questions you might have. Thanks.
Questions?
You get a linear model by walking a forest or tree.
Yeah.
And taking averages. Would you gain anything by not eagerly, walking the forest and taking averages, but exposing some of the decision making or state space to the soil?
I did not follow the last part.
So in the end, you send a linear model with a quadratic objective to your solver. And that's obtained by walking the decision
Correct.
Tree and forest and taking averages. So you make certain choices up front before you get your model. And I'm trying to understand whether there is anything to be gained by not making such choices up front, but giving more search space to the
The main reason we did this is to simplify the optimization complexity.
Yes.
Yeah.
I understand. I understand that it makes a lot of sense to do that.
Yeah.
You run into.
So then the remaining problem is basically.
Lots of problems if you weren't simplifying. But then the question is, suppose you had some great optimization tool.
Yeah.
What would the return on investment be?
Ideally, if you could solve this optimization without any problem, you'd want to use the exact or you don't want to do this simplification. For example, you might want to have a neural network right there, which would be like in the then in the optimization, you're basically inverting.
But do you have any idea whether there would be measurables, return on investment, or whether it's useless?
The whole point of doing this is we want some accurate models that can that you can use it for control.
Yes.
For this particular problem, having this kind of like two-step training process, simplifying this, works. It might not work for all applications. For example, we're capturing non-linearities in the disturbances through this structure. For example, if there are a lot of non-linearities in the control variable itself, then using a linear regression won't work.
That sort of outlines the assumptions. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, this approach might not work in any application like you can think of. There are some limitations, and to take it to other applications, we have to like work more and come up with some different tools.
By the way, Achin said that he's interested in collaboration with Microsoft building, etc. So he had a chat, he had a meeting with some facilities people in building 121 this morning.
Mm.
And he's also investigating interested in collaborative opportunities with the data center ops teams. So if we can connect him somehow to relevant people, that would be useful.
I'm also meeting another facility people actually at 11:30.
Okay. This is the guy that...
Yeah.
So we should go, you know, because
okay.
It's already 11:35.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming.
The Dynamics group is doing things. Actually, in Azure, I have a colleague who creates decision forests, so from